welcome to The Natural Selection. This week's theme is DNA. Welcome back, listeners, to The Natural Selection. We were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we have Naomi.
Hello.
We have Nick.
Hello.
And I am Nick. Hello. So, Nick, do you want to tell them who we are?
Yeah, we're The Natural Selection. If you haven't met us before, we're a group of taxonomists who gather each week to talk about the natural world. In the first section of our podcast, we'll talk about the news and any sort of crazy and cool and exciting or sometimes sad nature news that has come out in the past week or so. And in the second section of our podcast, we'll talk about a different theme each week and how it relates to the planet's wildlife. This week's theme is DNA.
Exciting. Something we've all got, I've heard. So that's good. But have you guys had a nice week? Have you encountered many animals?
A lot of pigeons, tons of pigeons. And actually, I started with pigeons, but really where I wanted to go was starlings. I saw a murmuration last night, just around twilight, and it was so beautiful. And it wasn't the kind that like morphs around and changes a lot. It was like a spherical ball, just like moving around in the air. It's really beautiful.
I've not seen anything like that. I've seen a lot of dogs in my walks in the park. But other than that, yeah, minimal animal activity.
I've noticed loads of those little birds that live in Berlin that I still to this day haven't got round to figuring out what they are, because they're really hard to actually spot what they look like because they move so quickly.
Colourful or drab?
The drab little ones that are like everywhere in like every bush, and they fly at about head height.
I don't want to disappoint you, but I feel like it's just a ground sparrow.
But I've never seen a city where they're so common.
It's a house sparrow. Because there are a bunch of houses here in Berlin.
Yeah, and they like house music.
Yeah. Oh, yes. It's a common misnomer. The appellation house sparrow actually refers to the type of music they appreciate.
Yeah. So it sounds we've had some quite interesting interactions. I mean, it was only dogs for Naomi, but I feel like any week full of dogs is a pretty good week. So yeah, should we come back after this short break with the news?
Definitely.
So we're here to talk about the news. We scour the internet to find interesting tidbits around nature that has appeared this week. And Nick, I believe you found something which is actually pretty old.
Heck yeah. You know that I usually work with mammals. Those of you who listen regularly know that mammals are my jam. And the mammal record goes back pretty far. But you know what goes back farther? Amphibians. So this week we're talking about some old amphibians, like 100 million years old. These guys were around when the dinosaurs were around, and they're in a type of amphibian group that doesn't exist today. They're sort of like, okay, so think about the amphibians we know. We've got the hoppers, frogs and toads. We've got the low walkers, the salamanders, and you have the slitherers, the Sicilians. So those are the three main body plans of the modern day amphibians. This group actually is called, you thought Sicilians was the tricky one. These are the Albanopetontids.
Albanopetontids?
Yeah, the Albanopetontids.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So this is an extinct group of amphibian, and it's one that had a different body type. It didn't walk on the ground, it didn't hop, and it didn't slither. It was a climber, which is a little bit more complex of a body plan, I would say, than what we're used to imagining modern amphibians having. But it's true, they climbed. They had good gripping feet, and their legs were sort of in the same arrangement that we see in climbing lizards today. Well, similar at least, homologous. There's a couple cool things about these guys. First of all, they're one of the only amphibians that we know of that had scales. When you think about amphibians, I mean, I think of those slimy, soft, amazing skin of a salamander guppy or something, you know, that just is like classic amphibian. But these had scales. And the coolest part is that this was preserved in amber. And after examining the jaw structure, the researchers who studied this, who were working all over the world, they decided that this thing ate like chameleons eat. And if you recall our favorite lizards, chameleons, they shoot their tongue out like a ballistic missile, so that the sticky end of their tongue will hit the prey and then just like elastic it back into their mouths. So the idea, based on the structure of the jaw joint and the musculature within the jaw, which is preserved in the amber, is that this group was a ballistic feeder, like chameleons, 100 million years ago, which is super cool and one of the first times that that evolved in evolutionary history.
It's really cool.
Tell that from a fossil. I guess that's the joy of being preserved in amber.
Yeah. There's some even of the end of the, like the base of the tongue is still preserved in the fossil in the amber.
Wow, that's really cool.
I've also got some pretty old news. Someone has discovered a new species of pterosaur. Can you think where they might have found this fossil?
Big old dinosaur pit.
Yeah, I think in a hole. No, it's in a drawer. It's in a drawer. It was in a drawer in a museum in Brighton called the Booth Museum. And it was labeled incorrectly. It was labeled as a fossilized shark fin. It was found by a PhD student called Roy Smith. He noticed that it was mislabeled because you can understand why they might look similar, because it was the very, very tip of the beak. And if you imagine that pointed tip might look like a shark fin. But what he noticed is that there were these tiny holes at the end of this beak where the nerves would have come through. This was sort of a fine feeding by the pterosaurs, and shark fins don't have this. So it appears the previous paleontologists had missed these tiny holes, and that's why they mislabeled it as a shark. He's not able to name it yet because it's such a small beak fragment that you're not able to sort of deduce the whole species. But it's like nothing else ever found. So he's hoping once lockdown is over that he'll be able to look around and see if he can find other fragments of this pterosaur.
Super cool. The best place to find new species is in the museum collections, but I don't think they were thinking of pterosaurs.
Yeah. So that's an amazing bit of luck on his part. Well, a skill as well to notice that it was mislabeled. But yeah, really exciting that you can find joy in the dustiest of drawers. But Naomi, you wanted to talk a bit about humans.
News is a little bit more recent than you guys. It is about ancient hunter-gatherer societies of humans. So this story was published in Science Advances by Haas et al. It was published at the end of October this year. So this was looking at female hunters. And this paper suggests that actually females may have hunted just as often as males in this early hunter-gatherer society in the late Pleistocene, early Holocene. So this is really interesting because in recent hunter-gatherer societies, it's considered to be a predominantly male activity. And so it was kind of thought that this was sort of the ancestral pattern, this like gender division of labor. But actually, it has been theorized because of the kind of conditions in these early societies that actually it would have made sense for everybody to kind of chip in and help in hunting. And there's a couple of reasons for this. So one of the conditions is that alloparenting would have happened, so that there would have been communal childcare. People would have helped out and help raise other people's children. Communal hunting would have been encouraged because the spear throwing devices they used, the atlatls, were kind of inefficient. So it was helpful to have a lot of people because it took time to reload them and there would have been a lot of work processing the meat and stuff. And it was helpful to have lots of people to do this. Also communal hunting, so trying to corral the animals and stuff would have been useful if lots of different people did this. And also this tool would have been easy to get proficient at from a young age. So would have been able to get proficient before women reached sexual maturity and before they would have had children. But generally, one thing to note is that in burial treatments, in these societies, things would have been buried with you if you would have used those things in life. So obviously it's a very complex and contingent idea, but generally it can be considered if something's buried with you, you would have used it as you lived as well. So sometimes when they find these hunting implements with females, they would disregard it because they would assume that they would have been used for something else instead of hunting. But this paper found a female burial site associated with a hunting toolkit, which were stone projectile points and animal processing tools from about 9,000 years ago. This was found in Peru, modern day Peru, and they decided to look at lots of burial sites across the Americas. They found 429 individuals from 102 sites. And of those, there was 27 individuals that they could identify the sex of that were found with big game hunting tools. And 11 of those were females. And this suggests that the female participation in hunting was non-trivial. So they were least as likely to hunt as men in this Pleistocene, early Holocene societies of hunter-gatherers, which is cool. And then as it kind of developed into the middle to late Holocene, when technology changes and other kind of labors comes in, then you kind of see the gender division where women would maybe be more the gatherers and men would be the hunters. Particularly, I think the bow and arrow technology, when that comes in, there's a bit more of a sex-biased leading with that tool use. But yeah, at this point, it seems that both men and women were hunters, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I've heard it's sort of linked to that, that societies which never invented the plow were more egalitarian because the plow could only be pulled by men, so it meant a stronger division of labor. And societies that didn't have the plow tended to view women and men more equally.
Just to finish off, the lead researcher of this work, Randy Haas, he said in a review article, labor practices among recent hunter-gatherer societies are highly gendered, which might lead some to believe that sexist inequality in things like pay or rank are somehow natural. But it's now clear that sexual division of labor was fundamentally different, likely more equitable in our species' deep hunter-gatherer past.
Cool. I like that.
I think that's a lovely note to end on. So you guys ready to talk about our theme?
Yes.
It's in my blood. Sorry, wrong episode.
Cool. Well, we'll be back after this short break. So we're here this week to talk about DNA. And it's one of the most famous images in science. I'd say along with that sort of basic image of an atom, that double helix of DNA is one of the iconic images that people use to say, this is science now. What do you guys know about the discovery of the structure of DNA?
It was by Watson and Crick.
Yeah. Is that all you know?
I feel Rosalind like Franklin.
There's one more name that you're missing. Well, Maurice Wilkins was the other one who won the Nobel Prize.
Not Rosalind Franklin.
No, but we'll get on to that. Because the story of it is you often hear contrasting stories about the discovery of the structure of who was responsible and who wasn't. But it's actually quite an interesting sort of arms race. So there was a lot of work going on. And Watson and Crick were desperately trying to do this. They were two, I think the polite way of putting it was interesting characters. So Crick is a quite interesting guy. He went from discovering the structure of DNA and then just abandoned that. And after doing so, he studied consciousness and human consciousness to see if there's a link between the sort of physical and metaphysical relationships that we have. James Watson, generally, he's not a nice man. He's not a nice man. He also weirdly makes an appearance in the book Girl Interrupted. She uses an example of someone who might be outside of the normal but is accepted by society. But yeah, he's littered with controversial statements with no basis in fact. And he doesn't come out of this story very well either. But there were two other people in this story, which is Rosalind Franklin and Maurice Wilkins. So they'd all been working to try and discover the structure of the DNA. And I believe that Watson and Crick had already tried to say that they'd discovered it, but everyone was like, no, this is clearly wrong. They'd made a mistake. So they were a bit puzzled. And Rosalind Franklin was working on a thing called X-ray crystallography, which you might have guessed in the 1950s, X-rays probably weren't that safe. So she was using a lot of radiation. And what is a very complex procedure that involved loads of calculations. But basically, you fire X-rays at certain crystals, and the patterns they make from reflecting off those crystals give an indication of that crystal structure. So that's what she was trying to do. And she was getting these patterns, but she didn't know what they meant. Now, she'd faced a lot of troubles. Sort of being a female scientist in that time was very much an uphill struggle, would continue to be to this day. So she would struggle to be taken seriously in her career. And this sort of came to a head because she got a job at King's. When she got back from a short break, she realized instead of being given the job alone, she was given the job with another man, which is Maurice Wilkins, and that they had to work together. Which neither of them were particularly happy about, which got into sort of like a Cold War situation where they wouldn't want to share any of their work. And eventually it got to a point where she got so annoyed that she left King's and she left her work behind, these images, because they belonged to King's College because it was the research she had done there. And it was at this point that King's College without her knowledge actually showed her work to Watson and Crick. It just so happens that they had been to a lecture where they knew what these images meant, and it meant that these DNA, the DNA was a double helix. So they ran home and they built it, and they went to the pub and they called the press, and they were sort of hailed as these geniuses who discovered the structure. Interestingly, they had actually been to Rosalind Franklin's lecture about a year before, so they could have actually got all this data, no problem. But looking at James Watson's diary from the day, rather than commenting on what she was talking about, which would have helped solve their problem, generally he just comments on her appearance and how she looked. So yeah, he doesn't come out of this story particularly well. Maurice Hawkins, an interesting chap. He went on to do very left-wing science and sort of social science, would lead groups to sort of give them credibility in that regard of, I know one of the projects they did was trying to discover why certain places smelled bad. Well, the government was denying there was a bad smell or that a factory is causing a smell, they would work. So they're like, no, this smell is caused by this factory next to this housing estate. So he went on to some interesting things. And when the Nobel Prize was awarded, it was awarded to Watson and Crick and Maurice Wilkins, but not Rosalind Franklin. Do you guys know why?
I think I have a guess. She was not alive anymore.
Yeah, that was my guess also.
Yeah. You can't get a Nobel Prize if you're dead, which Rosalind Franklin was by that point, likely because of the work she was doing, which is with X-ray crystallography. So she was the only one of this group to miss out on the Nobel Prize. So often her name was not recorded in the discovery. Nowadays, we tend to know much more about her, and she's credited with that. You can also see her picture in London if you go past King's College. There are pictures on the front there highlighting her work. Another example of when death has prevented someone from getting a Nobel Prize. Do you know who won the 1948 Nobel Peace Prize? It's nobody.
Oh.
Gandhi was assassinated. And because they couldn't award it because he'd passed away, it was only for living people, they poignantly awarded the Peace Prize that year to nobody. Mm. As a sort of, that was the closest they could get to awarding it to him. A controversial story already, the discovery of DNA. And it's not really been out of the news since, to be honest. But it has been in the news recently.
What I looked up this week is actually also about the Nobel Prize. So the Nobel Prize in Chemistry this year was won by two women, and it was won for their research on CRISPR. They transformed this obscure bacterial immune mechanism that's called CRISPR, which stands for, bear with me, clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats. So they turned it into a tool that can be used to simply and cheaply edit the genome of pretty much everything. There are other things before this that have been able to edit DNA in the genome, but this is much more efficient, more accurate, and easier to use than those. So the award went jointly to Emmanuelle Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna. They first showed that CRISPR could be used to edit DNA in an in vitro system. Since then, it's been used for lots of things. So it's been used in medicine, for agricultural products, ways to control pests. It's got lots of amazing implications. And interestingly, this is the first time that the Nobel Prize has been given to two women only. So it's the first time that two women have won it without a man also winning it.
Cool.
Yeah, so for editing, my understanding is CRISPR is really good at cutting DNA where you want it to be cut.
Accurate. So effectively, it's like scissors. It can cut specific chunks of DNA, and it can cut really small amounts of DNA as well, which is very useful because other ones, they're kind of limited to the size that they can do. So this can, I think, do like almost one base pair. It's so small and so accurate.
That's cool.
Naomi, there's a lot of cool stuff and a lot of scary stuff that seems like could come out of CRISPR. But CRISPR isn't the first type of genetic modification technology that's existed. Maybe you've heard of recombinant DNA, which is what a lot of the early sort of conversation in the beginning of the millennium about GMOs was sort of referencing. So CRISPR didn't exist yet, or at least not in the way that we know it now. But there was something called recombinant DNA, which is essentially, it's a very sort of crude in comparison way of injecting a sequence of DNA from one specimen or organism into another's DNA. And one of the sort of case studies that I want to bring to our discussion today that I found during my research and was totally just like gripped by is the glowfish. Have you guys heard of glowfish before?
Only in the vaguest of senses, not in any sort of DNA way.
So when I say glowfish, just for so everyone's on the same page here, I would need you to imagine the word in your head, and it's a capital G and L-O and then a capital F-I-S-H, one word, and it's a registered trademark. So it's owned by Yorktown Technologies, and they own many strains of glowfish. My favorite is Moonrise Pink, also a registered trademark. And basically, they started by doing recombinant DNA, taking strains of DNA that coded for fluorescence in corals and injecting them into zebrafish, and then selling them as aquarium pets. So you have fluorescently colored fish for your aquarium, and they come in many different colors, including, but not limited to, Moonrise Pink, Electric Green, and hold on.
Electric Green?
Yeah, also registered trademark.
Is electricity green?
No. The other colors that are also all registered trademarks include Starfire Red, Cosmic Blue, Sunburst Orange, and Galactic Purple. They exist now not just in zebrafish, but you can get tetras, you can get betas, you can get danios, you can get barbs, and you can now, if they've just released a line of sharks that are fluorescent. They're tiny, but they're sharks. So this is not the first time that there's been a trademark on a genetic lineage. But these phenotypes of fish that express fluorescence seem to me a sort of innocent, but maybe a Trojan horse in a way of entering the world of vertebrate genetic modification.
Yeah, a lot of DNA study is done on zebrafish, isn't it? It's one of the key species.
Yeah, it's a model species.
Them and Drosophila.
Yeah, and Arabidopsis in the plants. Yeah, I guess I just wanted to bring this up and say, isn't this horrifying and kind of cool? The way that we're seeing, I mean, there's of course some really amazing ways of dealing with genetic modification and making it benefit a lot of people. Like Naomi, you were talking about the modification of vectors for disease control. And that's something that is, I think, has a lot of a benefit and it's pretty controversial, but this is purely luxury. I mean, this is a commodity. It's for your aquarium. It's not for eating. It's not for, I mean.
Yeah, it's like fish eugenics. It's a bit weird.
Yes. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, exactly. Fish novelty eugenics. It's bizarre. But yeah, so I just thought that I'd bring this to all of our attention so that we have a little bit more fuel to our horror fire as we move forward into the future.
That's cool. So from one fish genome to another, I was fascinated by the marbled lungfish. Have you guys ever heard of the marbled lungfish?
No.
Yeah, fair enough. It's not that exciting. It's a lungfish, as is suggested. It's sort of got marbled texture.
Yeah, I'm going to cut in right here, Nick, and say, I just looked up a picture of the marbled lungfish. It's quite beautiful.
Each to their own, I suppose. It's not my type. I like zebrafish. No, I don't know what I like.
Artificially fluorescent fish.
Yeah, that's what I'm into. But this one is marbled. It's also known as the leopard lungfish. And you can find it in sort of Central Africa, Eastern Africa, places like that. It's also found in the Nile. So why would I bring this up? Well, I'll tell you why I bring it up. Because its genome is 133 billion base pairs long. That is the longest genome of any vertebrate.
Whoa.
Yeah, which is a bit odd. So, like, why the marbled lungfish? And the answer is, they don't know.
Yeah, I hate it when that happens.
So one of the interesting things about it, though, is that it does undergo metamorphosis. What they actually notice is a lot of vertebrates that have long genomes, amphibians, which also famously undergo metamorphosis, things like going from tadpoles into frogs or hoppers. And this does too. So when it is young, it actually has external gills. After about 3 months, these become gills as you would expect in another fish. So they thought that maybe this metamorphosis means that you have to have really, really big genomes. But they looked at more amphibians and found out that a lot of amphibians that undergo metamorphosis have pretty small genomes. So it doesn't make any sense. So currently, we're not exactly sure why the marbled lungfish would stand out amongst all vertebrates as having the longest genome. There must be some reason for this, but we don't know what it is. But it's not the longest genome of anything. Plants tend to have much larger genomes than animals anyway, for a various number of reasons. But the longest one we've found confidently is Paris japonica. This is the largest known genome for certain of any living organism. It's about 150 billion base pairs.
Too many.
To give you an idea, if you took the DNA from a single cell and stretched it out, that would be 91 meters long.
That's too long.
Yeah, so it's taller than Big Ben, just the DNA from one cell. There's sort of a tendency with humans to think that, like, not necessarily bigger is better, but bigger is more complex. Like the idea of like reading War and Peace is hard because it's so long. There's sort of complexity to it. And the longer something gets, the more complex it gets. But I mean, you wouldn't think of marbled lungfish as being the most complex vertebrate out there. And this plant, Pallas japonica, you wouldn't think, oh, this is the most complex organism we've ever found. So does it have a benefit? Well, probably not. Actually, they found that long genomes can be a hindrance. Plants with long genomes actually at greater risk of extinction. So it appears, I would have assumed logically that if you have a longer genome, there's more DNA which would help you adapt because there's more source for mutations and things. But no, it appears that they struggle in polluted soils and they are less able to tolerate extreme environment. So having a small genome might be more nimble and easier to manage. Of course, one of the obvious drawbacks is having so much DNA, having to make 91 meters worth for every cell, means that they grow slower. So they're actually a very slow growing plant because mitosis and meiosis just takes longer.
Huh, that does make sense.
I also found the smallest genome from any organism with a nuclei, so any eukaryotic cell, is actually a parasite. As I understand, symbiotic organisms are much more likely to have reduced genomes because, yeah, the other genome is doing the work for them. But this one is one that affects mammals. It's a mammalian parasite known as Encephalitozoon intestinalis, and it only has 2.25 million base pairs.
Poultry.
Yeah, so it goes from about 150 billion to 2.25 million.
Nick, inspired by your long and short DNA, I did a little research and some number crunching. So I'm going to take us on a journey through outer space. You told us that if you took the DNA from one cell of the Pallas japonica, if you took the DNA from one cell of Pallas japonica plant and stretched it out end to end, it would be taller than Big Ben. Do you know how long the DNA from one of our cells would be if we stretched it out?
No.
Apparently, only about 2 or 3 meters. Not so long. Oh. So here's my number crunching. I thought we'd go on a little journey. 2 to 3 meters per cell in the human body. And one estimate of cells in the human body is about 37 trillion, which seems like a lot. It is. And so if you multiply 2 to 3 meters by 37 trillion, you get something that would stretch about the same distance from here to the sun and back around 300 times. So if we stretch out all the DNA in all of our cells end to end, it would cover a lot of distance. But I'm not done.
Because they kill us as well.
It would actually also rip you apart cell by cell. Horrible. You could also do it for all of the people on Earth, and we're at about 7 billion right now. So multiply that by 7 billion, you get something like 65 million light years, which is about the distance to the galaxy NGC 3972, which is a beautiful spiral galaxy that was photographed by the Hubble recently in Ursa Major. It's about 65 million light years away, which means that traveling at the speed of light, it would take 65 million years to reach, which means that the light that's been traveling at the speed of light that's coming from it that we see now left the spiral galaxy around the time when the dinosaurs were dying out here on Earth. So that's all the human DNA we've got.
That's a lovely coincidence.
Isn't that nice? Right, yeah. Back to the beginning, dinosaurs.
That's bad taxonomy. Often DNA is used to compare animals and their relationship and how much DNA they share can infer a relationship. So, for example, we share 50% of our DNA with a banana. So that means we're half bananas. That's a fact. But we share 98% of our DNA with chimpanzees. I think all in all, we share about 99.9% of our DNA with every human being on Earth. Like, we're an incredibly related species, like really closely related compared to other animals. But yeah, we share 98% of our DNA with chimpanzees, which got me thinking, because I would like to think that we're actually quite different from chimpanzees. So are we just 2% different? Is that what it means? So I had a look to see in our genomes where those differences lie. And what's quite interesting is the genetics of our brains, which is what human beings tend to think is what separates us from the animals, the genes which code for chimpanzee brains are pretty much identical. There's not a key difference there. One of the most obvious differences is actually our immune system. So our immune systems appear to have a lot of differences. And this can be quite interesting because there are diseases that we know that we can handle that they can't, and vice versa. So they're better at actually handling malaria. We struggle a lot more with malaria than chimps do, but we're much better at handling tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is much, much harsher on chimps. So one of the other big differences is in the genes which control olfaction. They have many more genes controlling the ability to smell than we do because they have a much better sense of smell. So what it would appear is actually we've lost a lot of those genes as our sense of smell has become less important. But those are two massive differences. But when you look at the genes, there's not actually that much difference. But what there is difference in, and it's like sort of sprinkled around, is the bits around genes. So historically, this was called junk DNA, which is actually a terrible name for it, because we now start to realize it does stuff. But when they were first looking at it, they said, well, it's not a gene, so it's just junk. Now we call it non-coding DNA, because while it doesn't actually make anything, it might act as like a switch or a bit like a recipe. So while it might not be an ingredient, it might be a recipe to help build this organism. And the bits around the genes which control this recipe actually quite different. So it could be as simple as, say, for example, with neurons, where we have many more neurons in our brain than they do, it could be that there's just a minor difference next to it which says how many to make. So even though the ingredients are the same, the recipe might be slightly different. And that's what can cause these big changes. So it appears these small changes in these regulatory genes actually has a huge difference.
That's really cool. Interesting, actually. So you were talking about differences between humans and chimps, but something that humans and chimps definitely have in common is what I wanted to talk about, and that's Hox genes. And that's because most animals have Hox genes. They're a really conserved group of genes. And what they are is homeotic genes, which means that they're regulatory genes. And so they code for proteins, and the proteins that they make are transcription factors. And what transcription factors do is regulate the expression of other genes. So that's basically a fancy way to say they turn on and off other genes. So they basically control cascades of different regulatory patterns. So what these Hox genes, what's really cool about Hox genes is the order that they are in on the chromosome is the same order that they're expressed in the body. So they are in charge of basically laying out the body plan for organisms. So this is really cool. And the way that they have looked at how these genes work and how they do is mostly in Drosophila, which are flies. So some of the ways they do this is by looking at what happens when there's problems with these genes or when there's mutations with these genes. So I just thought I'd talk about a couple of these interesting examples on how they figured out what these genes do. So one is called Antennapedia. And so this is a gene that's expressed in the thorax segment of the Drosophila. And in a normal functioning Drosophila, it would code for the first legs of the Drosophila. When this is expressed in a different part of the Drosophila, so in the head, say, legs will grow instead of antenna. And so the reason it's called Antennapedia is because it's based on the mutation and how they discovered what this gene does. Another cool one that they found was, well, not so cool for the flies that have it, but it was called Ultra Bithorax. And so this lays out the body plan for another part of the thorax, the part that would make the haltiers. So just a quick fly anatomy. Flies have one set of wings, and then their second set of wings have been modified into haltiers. But in this Ultra Bithorax mutant, what happens is a second set of wings grow instead of the haltiers. And basically what's happened here is that in this mutant that I'm talking about, the Ultra Bithorax has stopped working. So this gene isn't laying out the body part as it should. But what's interesting about how the Hox genes work is not only do they say what should go there, but they also say what shouldn't go there. So basically what happens in this case is that the other gene before it is still getting expressed. So you get a duplication of this segment. So you get two of those wing segments sections instead of the segment you should get. In the Drosophila, they only have one set of Hox genes, but humans and a lot of other animals have more. So humans have four. These duplication events might be important because it would allow a lot more kind of playing around with body plans without it being detrimental because there's spare copies.
That's some complex stuff, but I think that was really clear. Thanks.
Yeah, so basically you're saying that because there's an extra copy, if you change the second one, it doesn't matter because the first one's still there, so it can still do its important thing. But now you have a second one to maybe do something extra.
Exactly, yeah.
So what would a Hox gene do in us?
They're also important for body plan. In humans, mutations in the Hox D13 gene cause a genetic condition called cynopolydactyly, which people are born with extra fingers or toes that may also be fused together. So I think with humans, because there's different clusters of these Hox genes, I think it's harder to kind of piece apart what is responsible for each different kind of cascade. It tends to get a little bit more complex, but this is one example where they can show this mutation in this gene causes this. So I guess it's responsible for the hands and feet and digits.
That one that you just mentioned, the 13, Hox 13, I just saw a talk earlier this week about that gene, looking at the evolution of the vertebrate limb. And it seems that wherever you put that gene, it ends things. It puts the ends on whatever the body plan is. So it's pretty modular. But in fish fins, it puts on the, like, you know, the on some fish, they have that sort of broad fin at the end that's made up of many small, like, tubes, tubule fragments. Not fragments, but like tubes at the end of the fin that make the fin stiff and flexible. That's coded by the Hox 13 gene, but also, as you said, it's the sort of the end of the limb, the hand, in humans and in other mammals and reptiles. So when you're missing the Hox gene or when you turn it off, you get up to the end of the wrist. And in these fish, you get just the, like, stub of the limb without the tubes, creating the ray or the sort of expanse of the fin. And then you can also add the Hox 13 gene to, say, the end of the tail, and it will sort of end, it will end the tail or extend the end of the tail. And additionally, depending on what the tail of whatever body, whether you're putting into a reptile or a mammal or what have you. So it's sort of like the terminus gene. I spent a bit of time this week looking at epigenetics, which is something that I've known a little bit about, but not so much. And I wanted to know more, and it's complicated, it seems. But I'll try to give you I'll give you guys a brief overview of what I learned about epigenetics this week using a couple of examples. So epigenetics is a concept or a study, field of study, coined by an English embryologist. So he was working in Evo Devo, working in the 1950s, and he was trying to understand whether there could be things passed down from parent to offspring that weren't marked in the DNA, like things that weren't genetically coded, but that showed that there was some sort of heredity, or things that weren't quite totally controlled by the genes in a literal way. So one of the classic sort of examples of this is if you have identical twins, they have the exact same DNA. And sometimes you get identical twins, say one of them will develop schizophrenia, which is a genetic disease, but then the other twin won't develop it. And those instances are sort of interesting, like why not? And what are the differences here that are coding these differences? So this sort of epigenetics means above genetics, or I think loosely, like, around genetics. But it's this idea of that there's some sort of cell memory that happens in the genome that changes it without making a change to the actual base pair coding. So one of the classic examples or longest term studies of this in humans is related to a really horrific period of recent history, World War II, and looking specifically at what was called the Hunger Winter in Northern Holland. So when German troops invaded Holland, they cut off transport to Northern Holland, to cities like Rotterdam and Leiden, and no food could get there for the winter in 1944. And many people starved to death, and the rest of the population was starving for several months until the lines of transportation were able to open again. And many people survived, including many children. One of them was Audrey Hepburn, as a sort of strange aside. She was living there at that time. Then those children that survived that famine suffered chronic health issues associated with malnourishment for the rest of their lives, as you would expect after going through a severe famine. Depression, anxiety, heart disease, gum disease, diabetes, osteoporosis, this sort of thing. And that was sort of the main results of this study that was really sort of a horrible accident that allowed a large population to be looked at. Like, how does a population that goes from eating normally and well to go and deal with a period of starvation? Until the 80s, when the children who were born to the women who were pregnant during the famine grew up, and it was found that they had higher rates of obesity and heart disease than their, like, other people in Holland, other people in the world that didn't go through this period of starvation. So, which makes sense. It's not unexpected that you would see children who experienced a famine in the womb grow up and also show the presentations of going through a period of stress, of malnourishment. So you see this sort of like the body's response to not getting enough food at a certain point in its life, even if that's pre-birth, is to sort of collect and safeguard the stores of energy and food when they can, which is why you get this sort of obesity. Well, that's a very simplified way of saying it, but I think that's part of the process. But then in the 1990s, when the grandchildren of people who were exposed to the famine were studied, they also had higher rates of obesity and heart disease. So something had happened in not the DNA, because three generations is too short in any individual lineage to have mutations that would affect something as severe and systemic as heart disease and obesity, but something around the genome, or something about above the genome, something epigenetic, was marked in these lineages that created this sort of memory of trauma or stress in the genome that is that doesn't show in the DNA. So there's something going on, that some gene that's being turned on, or some combinations of things that's marked this lineage in some way that we're still trying to figure out. But let me shift away a little bit from the hunger winter, which is quite not the note that I want to end on, and talk a little bit about how epigenetics in diploid animals works. So in females, what will often happen is that the females have two X chromosomes. So males have X and a Y, and females have an X and an X. And in most females, randomly, a cell will choose to reduce or even like shrivel up one of the X chromosomes. Because there's two of them, it doesn't really damage the cell at all. But sometimes, because those X and X are from the mother and father, there's genes that are expressed from one that are expressed differently in the other's chromosome. It's almost entirely random, it seems. Cells next to each other often show the same thing, but then sometimes it's sort of a mosaic of these two different cell expression types. And you may be thinking, okay, but that doesn't happen to me, and it's like normal. But this blew my mind. You know calico cats and tortoiseshell cats?
Yeah.
What do you know, any crazy facts about calico and tortoiseshell cats?
They're all women.
They're all women. Exactly. And that's because the gene expression for fur coloration in cats is on the X chromosome. So the cells at random choose to shrivel up either the mother's or the father's X chromosome. And then at random, they express either the light or the dark coloration, which is why you get the patchy fur in only the female cats, because the males keep both the X and Y. So this is sort of an epigenetic marker of, like, it's not coded in the genome, but it's expressed phenotypically in a way where the body is doing something with the genome that is beyond just creating proteins. So I managed to bring it back to the animal world after all, after taking a detour through the very non-animal, wink, wink, human world.
It's quite nice you're only talking about the sex chromosomes, because of what we're going to talk about next week, which are very much involved in that, which is eggs.
I mean, it's going to take me a couple days to incubate some ideas about this.
I've already had an earth of your puns. Yeah, so I guess we'll see you guys next week.
Ta-ta.
Bye.
Bye, everyone. So Naomi, is cereal soup?
It's gazpacho. Gestapo is the secret police.
I know. I thought you were making a joke. That's why I didn't correct you.